Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks for tuning in to Connecting Faith. Glad to have you along. I'm Neil Stavem. Ted Rouse at the controls. Carissa's at the phones. And we're less than a week away now from fall share.
That's right. So. Starting up next Tuesday the 12th, you can make your gift now. Help us get started strong. 877-93-FAITH or online, you know, myfaithradio.com.
We do look forward to hearing from you, and thank you in advance for your partnership. We say and talk about on Connecting Faith oftentimes about ideas. Ideas have consequences. Of course, bad ideas often have bad consequences. And we're going to talk about some bad ideas today and the dreadful consequences of bad arguments, we'll put it that way. One of the interesting, maybe distinguishing characteristics of the so-called new atheism is it's a moral certitude. You've heard that, you know, the late Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, others, they've all declared that atheism has finally and convincingly won the war against Christian theism. But maybe just because they're loud doesn't mean they're right.
That's right, yeah.
My grandmother used to say this, empty vessels make the most noise. I think that's actually,
that's true.
We may find that as true. And here's something from historian N.T. Wright, who said, it may be time to be skeptical about skepticism itself.
Yeah.
So we're going to address the skeptics today, the atheist, and the believer in assuring and confirming, I think, our faith. We're looking forward to a good conversation about a book that came out not too long ago called The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, or Other Dreadful Consequences of Bad Arguments. And there's a lot of great chapters in this book, like The Santa Delusion, Humpty Dumpty and the Vegan, The Peculiar Case of the Postmodern Penguin. And so
sounds like a nightmare. Well, our
guest has had a few of those too, I think. But we're looking forward to talking today with Dr. Andy Bannister. He's a popular speaker, author, and broadcaster. Speaks and teaches regularly throughout Canada, the U.S., Europe, and the wider world, addressing audiences of all faiths or none on issues relating to faith, culture, politics, and society, philosophy, belief, and more. And he spends a good deal of his time working with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, but also is working in his home in Scotland now to help bring about apologetics to the area where he's working. In fact, he has a doctorate in Islamic studies, so interesting background. And of course, he's got an accent, too, which has been the main reason that we want Andy to come on the show. So, Andy, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Great to be with you, and I have no idea what accent you are possibly talking about.
It'll go well the rest of the hour. I think we should mention that Andy is connecting with us from Scotland via Skype, and we're going to talk about the atheist who didn't exist. And you point out, as the subtitle suggests, that dreadful consequences of bad arguments, that, you know, bad arguments can be disseminated pretty widely and quickly. And I'm just wondering, is that because the public's not really discerning to know enough that they're flawed?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's one of the issues. I also think we live in an age of social media, and so ideas can take root much more quickly. And also, at the same time, I think, you know, all credit to them, the so-called new atheists, people like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris on your side of the Atlantic, Daniel Dennett and others, have done a magnificent job, I think, advocating for atheism. They're funny, they're clever, they play the media very, very well. And they've definitely succeeded, I think, putting atheism kind of out there. But as you hinted at in the introduction, I think what led me to write the book was just looking at their arguments and thinking, look, for all of the clever presentation, I didn't think there was a lot of substance behind them. And I found it sort of increasingly frustrating that people weren't asking the questions that need to be asked. And so The Atheist Who Didn't Exist was an attempt to really kind of use humor, I think, a little bit to respond to this. I'd seen lots of Christians write, sort of quite dry academic books responding to some of this atheism. But the problem is those books were boring and nobody was reading them. And so really my book was an attempt to try and write something that somebody might actually want to read, that you could even give to an atheist friend and say, look, you won't agree with everything that Andy says, but hopefully you'll enjoy yourself as you read the book.
And if for no other reason than just the footnotes probably are a lot of fun. But
Well, I like to think it is the first book where you want to go back a second time and read the footnotes. They, I like to think they are definitely worth reading. In fact, I think it makes the book worth twice the cover price. So if people buy this book and enjoy the footnotes, they can feel free to, you know, put $10 in the post and mail and send it across.
Sure. Well, we're all about your advancing your retirement account as much as we can, I think. But
incredibly generous of you. Thank you.
It's a full service show here on Connecting Faith. You know, names you mentioned, like Dawkins and Harris and others, I mean, they seem pretty, you know, sophisticated and sure themselves, but a lot of the arguments, it seems like, were kind of sound bites and maybe simplistic. Are they aware that, you know, sound bites aren't going to hold today, or do they just say weak point, pound pulpit here?
You know, I think that's a great question, and I think I always want to be sort of fair to both sides. I mean, Christians are not immune from soundbites too. I sort of grew up in a culture where, you know, Christians were, you know, one of my contemporaries were fond of slapping Christian soundbites on T-shirts and bumper stickers and so forth. And I think that can quite already be challenged on in our side of things. But I think behind the atheist side, what I found intriguing was behind the soundbites among our atheist friends, I don't think there was any substance. You know, if somebody accuses a Christian of a soundbite argument, I think hopefully there's the ability to go, look, okay, yes, guilty as charged, but look, here is something more substantive. What I wasn't seeing on the atheist side was that substance. But the thing is, I think soundbites work very well in the social media age again. They tweet well, they're very clever, they're funny. But of course, we always, whenever you hear a soundbite, it's always worth asking the question, is that soundbite true?
Did this come, your interest? Was it something developed over a long time? I mean, because you did the doctorate studies in Islamic studies, so that doesn't seem like necessarily something that would be talking about the, you know, new atheists. How did that sort of interest come?
Yeah, I mean, I've really, for the last kind of 20 years or so, had a kind of twin track. I mean, academically, it was Islam was where I was interested. Growing out, a lot of conversations I had with Muslim friends in London, where I used to live, and eventually a lot of those conversations about faith led me to do a PhD in Islam so I could understand my Muslim friends better and hopefully share Christ more effectively with them. But at the same time, I've always kept an interest in philosophy, had taught at the university kind of level. So I was always interested in atheism. But what was interesting, it wasn't really until 2006 that atheism became mainstream. That was the year that the new atheism first kind of hit the airwaves. And in fact, the term the new atheism was first coined in 2006 by a journalist at Wired magazine. And that was, I think that was the year that Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, came out. I remember sort of thinking, now this is interesting. You know, for years, I'd always associated atheism with a slightly geeky person sitting in the corner of the party with no friends. And, you know, it wasn't really mainstream, wasn't really getting anywhere. And what Dawkins and Dennett and others managed to do was kind of popularize it. And I suddenly found myself thinking, okay, somebody needs to respond to this. Because as I say, lots of Christians I found were writing academically and responding, but not really getting traction. And I think what the new atheists did was work out how to get traction for their arguments. And so as I sort of thought about how to do this, I came across a comment that the Christian writer C.S. Lewis once made. I'm sure many of your listeners, you know and love Lewis. And on one occasion, he was talking about why he, after writing lots of works of philosophy and theology, why he set out to write the Narnia books, his fiction. And he said, I'd noticed, he said, that often you can't get arguments past the front door of people's minds because those front doors, as it were, are guarded by watchful dragons. But he said, I wonder whether, you know, using fiction and story, we might tiptoe past those watchful dragons and kind of sneak truth in the side door. And I found myself thinking, you know, I can't write fiction like Lewis, but I have been told I'm quite funny. So maybe we could tickle the dragon under the nose. And while it's rolling on the floor laughing, we can charge in with truth through the front door.
You know, we're all in favor of that. I think, you know, tickling dragons is that does sound like, you know, better than the typical option, I guess. You know, one of the things I was mentioning here before the show, I heard Alistair Begg commenting not too long ago about Romans 1 and 2, of course, where that, you know, spells out pretty clearly about how, you know, evidence for God is, you know, available. But he said, no one is born an atheist. Is this a choice because we don't want to believe or don't want to obey? I mean, what's the driving force behind it?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And I think there's three things going on as I've interacted with hundreds of atheists across the years and read, you know, a lot of the books. I mean, certainly for some atheists, absolutely. I think the atheism is really a moral issue going on. They don't want to bow the knee. They want to be autonomous. They want to be in charge of their own lives. And that's not me saying it. There are atheists who admit that. So in my book, in fact, I quote a very famous 20th century atheist called Aldous Huxley, who basically admitted, he says, you know, he wanted to live his life, particularly in terms of sexual freedom, a particular way. He figured out that, you know, Christianity didn't allow that. So the easiest way to deal with that was to dismiss Christianity and embrace atheism. So there's clearly a moral rebellion. But we also be careful, that doesn't cover every atheist. I meet many atheists who would say they're atheists because they've had a bad experience with Christianity. And I think we need to take that very seriously, that at times the church has done real damage to people. People have had bad experiences of church where there should have been good ones. And I meet many atheists who, when you dig into their stories, because of something that was said, something that was done, they wrote the whole thing off because they had a bad experience with a particular group of Christians. And that's a whole different approach. There, I think that requires listening, it requires compassion, it requires us demonstrating that, okay, somebody may have done something horrific in the name of Christ, but that doesn't mean that Christianity is itself false. It means that Christians are, like everybody else, messed up, broken people. And then thirdly, I think you will meet atheists who do have genuine intellectual difficulties. There's an objection that they can't get past, like a very common one that I run into is the problem of evil. I know many people who look, you know, at the kind of world that we live in with all that's going on right now and have genuinely concluded for what they believe to be good reasons that they can't take belief in God seriously because of that problem. And in that case, I think it's our job to sit down carefully and explain to them why we think they're wrong, why we think there are good reasons to believe in God. And of course, you know, the Bible is thoroughly behind that. 1 Peter 3 verse 15, always be prepared to give a reason for the hope that you have. And do this with gentleness and respect. So I think those are three very different reasons. And so I always stress to people, if you've got atheist friends, colleagues, neighbors, classmates, try and start by finding out, why is the person you're talking to an atheist? Ask them. Just ask them the question, why are you an atheist? Why don't you believe in God? And often they'll outright tell you, and then you can determine the approach you want to take based on that.
We'll spend some time asking some questions and getting some answers. And you're welcome to join the conversation with Andy Bannister, Dr. Bannister, popular author, speaker, and broadcaster, and he's written a book we're referencing today called The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, or The Dreadful Consequences of Bad Arguments. Andy spends part of his time working with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. He also has a ministry in Scotland that is working and centering in the area of apologetics. And he's joining us today via Skype, and we'll continue just a moment with more. You can call us at 877-933-2484 if you have a question, or you can submit something online. If you go to myfaithradio.com, you can click on the Connecting Faith show page. There's an email link there. You can submit your question or comment there, and we'll get to it in the moments ahead here on Connecting Faith. Romans 1 and 2 remind us that God has made himself known to us. But there are many today who don't see God in the picture at all. We're talking about the atheist, and particularly referencing a book from Dr. Andy Bannister called The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, or The Dreadful Consequences of Bad Arguments. And it's an enjoyable read to address, you know, some of the underlying issues behind an atheist argument. Andy spends a good deal of his time with Ravi Zacharias Ministries and speaking and writing and teaching on apologetics as a ministry in Scotland, where we're talking to him today. But Andy, let's talk about, you know, the idea of maybe a disbelief in God. Is if we don't believe in God, is that sufficient to not have to defend the idea? Is the absence of belief exempt from defense?
The simple answer is no, it isn't. And it's interesting that it's something you'll hear some atheists claim quite a lot. They'll claim there's no burden of proof, that it's the burden of proof is on Christians, and that an atheist is somebody who simply lacks a belief. They merely lack a belief in God. And if you lack something, if that's all that atheism is, just a lack of belief, then you don't have to defend it. And the problem is that fails on all kinds of levels. It fails, I mean, at the start out, right out, it fails philosophically, because philosophically, if you make a statement, make a proposition, you have to defend it. And the proposition, there is no God, requires defending in the same way as the belief there is a God. But the other problem I think the idea that atheism is merely the lack of a belief runs into is it fails on all kinds of sort of unintended levels as well for the atheist. I mean, if atheism is merely the lack of belief in God, then, you know, small rocks and, you know, rubber chickens and Richard Dawkins' left foot, they all lack a belief in God, so they are presumably atheists. It seems a little bit odd to say a rock is an atheist or a rubber chicken is an atheist. And then furthermore, of course, the other thing, one of the things about beliefs that is notable about them is beliefs tend to be sort of identity forming for people. So as Christians, we call ourselves Christians. We gather together as Christian communities. Being a Christian shapes my identity, as it probably does for you and for many listening to this. But what about atheism? If atheism is merely the lack of belief in God, then it should have no effect at all. But that's not the case. I regularly run across people who self-define as atheists, who change their social media profile to amusing little pictures of the flying spaghetti monster and other kind of atheist logos. I regularly run across atheist clubs and societies on university campuses. You know, high-profile atheists like Richard Dawkins write books about atheism. And the more you look at this, the more you are forced to the conclusion atheism is a belief. It may not be a religion, although even that we could argue, but it's certainly a belief. And because it's a belief, it needs to be defended. And all I'm saying to my atheist friends, I'm not playing fast and loose here, simply saying, look, all of us have things that we believe deeply. Christians do, Muslims do, Hindus do, Buddhists do, and atheists do as well. And your most deeply held beliefs about life and reality and the universe and so all these kind of things and God and so forth, we need to come to the table, admit what our beliefs are, and then be prepared to defend them and explain the reasons why we believe them to be true.
One of the things you address, you talk about transferring an argument to a different setting to test its worth. What does that look like?
Well, one of the things I notice that sometimes when we engage with these arguments, either what our atheist friends are saying or Christian responses, if you're not if you're not particularly sort of into sort of philosophy and theology, sometimes this can seem to get a sort of bit complex quite quickly. And transferring something into a more popular setting or a very different setting can often help you see the problem in the argument. So let me give you a very good example. The idea that atheism is merely the absence of a belief. In the book, I use an illustration to explain what's wrong with that argument. Many of us may look at that claim and go, well, what's wrong with it? Well, one way to illustrate what's wrong with it is like this. Imagine that you were sitting in a coffee shop, you were sitting in your local Dunkin' Donuts, or if you were richer than I, you were in Starbucks, or Six Bucks, we used to call it in Toronto. and you're sitting there having coffee with a friend, and suddenly your friend announces that they don't believe in Sweden. They actually don't believe that the country of Sweden exists. And you kind of splutter over your latte and you say, well, That's incredible. What's your evidence for this? And they look at you and go, ah, oh, no. You see, I just lack a belief in Sweden. I don't have to defend that. It's you who believe in Sweden that needs to defend your belief. But me, who doesn't believe in this particular small Scandinavian legendary country, I have no burden of proof. Now, we would instantly see the problem there. Anybody looking at it can see, well, you know what? There's something obviously wrong with that idea. And that little illustration, I think, helps us see what a fallacious idea it is to say that not believing in something doesn't require a defense.
Mm. You know, it does seem that, it's easy to maybe dismiss some arguments as not likely, but then others get affirmed. And I guess, you know, we all are maybe subject to that, where we will dismiss some but affirm others. Say a bit more about that.
Well, I think a number of things I'd say around there. I think one of the things we need to be careful of, and as Christians we need to be conscious of this as well. You know, it's very, very easy merely to simply to hold on to and embrace and adopt arguments that support your own position and treat them more fairly than those that are against it. So as Christians, you know, a natural disposition is anything that appears to support our Christian faith we grab hold of, and anything that makes, you know, atheists or Muslims or Hindus look bad, however bad that argument is, we kind of grab hold of it and go, hooray, isn't it wonderful? And I think it's right for people to call ours out when we do that. But we can certainly call our atheist friends out when they do the same thing. It's not merely Christians who are fond of that. And I'm always going to be very careful and very fair and say that there are bad Christian arguments and there are bad atheist arguments. There are also really good Christian arguments. For example, the evidence for the resurrection is a fantastic argument. There's incredibly strong evidence for the resurrection. So as Christians, we should talk about that. I haven't yet personally seen a very, very strong argument for atheism. I've seen better arguments than others, but I haven't yet seen anything that's as powerful as the evidence for Christianity. And ultimately, that brings me back, and I always want to say this to people when I'm dialoguing and engaging with them, look, there's only one reason to believe that to believe in Christianity, and that's if it's true. If it's true, you should believe it. If it's not true, then you should abandon it tomorrow. That's what matters ultimately. The reason I'm a Christian is not because I was raised that way or because it's comfortable or easy for me or any of those things. The reason I'm a Christian is because I believe it to be true. The reason I'm not an atheist is I believe atheism to be false.
You, in the book, The Atheist Who Did Exist, you suggest there are some similarities between the new atheism and Islam. And I know you've done a lot of research on Islam. Explain a bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, over the years, I've been sort of studying Islam now for sort of 15 to 20 years. And one of the things I've noticed, and again, we've got to be careful not to tar everybody with the same brush, but certainly for many Muslims I meet, they believe Islam to be self-evidently true. They're not really willing to ask critical questions about their faith. And really, they're not really willing to treat any position other than Islam kind of seriously. And so when I engage with Muslims, for example, I see a lot of caricatures of Christian faith represented. And as I began studying the new atheism, it struck me just how bizarre it is in a sense that all of those three statements hold true for the new atheism. Now, again, not for every atheist. I know some very generous atheist writers and thinkers who would take Christian arguments very seriously. But certainly the new atheism behaves in the same way. You know, Richard Dawkins thinks that anyone who's not an atheist is an idiot. You know, he calls us dyed-in-the-wool faith heads. That's very similar to the way that some Muslims talk about non-Islamic faith. Most atheists I know have never actually looked into the evidence against atheism. They spend most of their time just sort of dealing in their arguments against Christianity, and so it goes. And so I think there are a number of similarities, and I think that when you push into that, well, the common connection is fundamentalism. And fundamentalism is a word that's thrown around a lot in our culture, and sometimes it can just be an insult. Sometimes it's just used to mean somebody who believes something more passionately than I do. But I think a better description of fundamentalism is somebody who believes something, who has never even looked at the alternatives, who's got their fingers in their ears, refusing to even listen to people who think differently, who wants to demonize those who think differently, and so on and so forth. And that's not biblical Christianity. I'm always very clear to Christian audiences and to atheist audiences too. The Bible encourages Christians to think about the evidence for our faith. Christianity is an evidence-based faith. You know, in the book of Acts, that first kind of evangelistic sermon that's preached in Acts chapter 2, a few days after the resurrection, Peter doesn't just say to the gathered crowds on the day of Pentecost there, doesn't just say, hey, believe because you should believe because you believe. He talks about evidence. He points to the empty tomb. He talks about the resurrection done in the full light of history. He gives reasons why you can believe the Christian faith to be true. And the Bible commends faith, but it doesn't commend blind faith. And I think blind faith is very dangerous. So I see blind faith among some of my Muslim friends, and I certainly see it in the new atheism.
We're going to continue the discussion in a moment. We'll circle back, talk a little about the fundamentalism. There's this, suggestion that the wars and evil, all that is because of religious extremism, whether it's on Islam or Christianity side. We'll get Andy Bannister's reflections on that. He's a speaker, author, broadcaster. And he enjoys, in his free time, mountaineering, juggling, and cats, although not simultaneously, as he says, which I think is important. Talking about the book, The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, and you can join the conversation at 877-933-2484. I hope that our conversation, Opening Eyes, as well, that Andy Bannister's book certainly will help you as you deal with those that maybe claim atheism. And you can think a little bit deeper about some of the popular claims that they have. The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, or The Dreadful Consequences of Bad Arguments. As we say often, ideas have consequences, bad ideas have bad consequences. Dr. Andy Bannister is a speaker, author, and broadcaster, and does a lot of speaking and teaching through Ravi Zacharias International Ministries in Canada and the U.S. and Europe and around the world, and has a ministry in Scotland. We're talking to him today via Skype. And we're talking before the break a little bit about, Islam and the fundamentalism. And, it seems like there's an argument that sometimes is offered that religion is the cause of wars and evil, and that Christianity is, in its extreme as bad as Islam is in its extreme. What's your perception on that issue?
It's a great question, and one I think that's being asked, you know, ever more in the kind of world we live in when we open the newspapers every day and see examples of religiously inspired violence. I want to say a couple of things. Firstly, I want to address the broader issue that's sometimes behind there, this idea that religion poisons everything. In fact, that was Christopher Hitchens, the famous atheist, who said that line. And I know many atheists who would claim that, you know, religion has been cause of, you know, most of the wars and violence in history. And I think there it's very important to push back and say that simply isn't true. I mean, it's just demonstrably false. There was a massive book came out a few years ago called the Encyclopedia of Wars. And in three huge volumes, the editors of that book have studied 1,763 wars that took place between 8,000 BC and 2003. And it's interesting, of those 1,763 wars, they only categorized 123 as religious. That's 7% of all wars in 10,000 years of history. So I always jokingly say to my atheist friends, look, if religious people are the ones trying to cause all the wars in history, we're slackers in this regard. We've got quite a lot of work to do. Most wars in history are actually caused by government, particularly in more modern warfare. And if we're going to ban anything, we should ban government. Now, what about Islam, though? So, okay, one of the issues here, of course, is that right now we're dealing with a resurgent Islam with a fundamentalist Islamist streak within that. And thankfully, it's a minority of Muslims, but it's still a significant minority. And I think one of the things here we need to push into is to say, look, you know, religion is in some ways a very unhelpful term. You know, it hasn't often occurred to my atheist friends that most people don't think of themselves as religious. I don't know about you. I don't get up in the morning and think, hey, I am a religious person. I have a religion. I think of myself as a Christian. I have faith in Christ. And the problem with using religion as this kind of bucket category, it jams things together. And it assumes that, well, Islam is just basically the same as Christianity, but with beards and burqas. And I think what we need to encourage people to do is to actually look into the teachings and the beliefs of the different religions. And they are vastly, vastly different. There are huge differences between Christianity and Islam, just as there are huge differences between Islam and Buddhism. And in fact, Buddhism is an interesting example because it takes Christianity off the table for a moment. And it's very, very interesting to look what happened when the Chinese motored into Tibet a few years ago and, you know, brutalized that largely Buddhist country. We didn't see Buddhist monks en masse blowing themselves up in public, committing, you know, huge terrorist atrocities. And that wasn't their response to, you know, demonstrably violent provocation, which tells you there's a profound difference between Buddhism and, say, a religion like Islam that would probably responded quite differently. And there are huge differences, again, between Islam and Christianity. And the biggest difference between Islam and Christianity lies in the founder. Because in Muhammad, we have a man who was a warlord and a warrior, a charismatic military leader. That's not to insult him, it's to put him in his place in history. He was a spectacularly successful military leader, laid the seeds for a great empire. And on the other hand, you have Jesus Christ, one to whom violence was done. And thus, when you see a Christian behaving violently, you need to take them to Jesus Christ and say, how can you call yourself a Christian when you're following somebody who said, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you? On the other hand, when you meet a Muslim who's inclined towards behaving violently, I want to get them as far away from the historical Muhammad as I possibly can, because he was a man who did use violence. And the best way to expose that, as I say, is go back to the founders. Rather than talk about Islam and Christianity in the abstract, let's talk about Jesus. Let's talk about Muhammad. Let's stand their two lives side by side and ask ourselves, given the fractured, divided 21st century world we live in, which offers the greatest model for bringing people together and helping us find ways to unite despite our differences? I don't think Muhammad is the best example. I do think Jesus is.
Hmm. There's one of the other frequent arguments, I guess, or props for atheism is science. In fact, science covers a lot of things. It's become kind of a religious force and holds the answers to everything, or at least so it says. So if science can't explain it, it can't be real. Talk about science.
Well, of course, you're absolutely right that I think science has become kind of almost like a de facto religion for some. And this idea that if you can't explain, if science can't explain it, it isn't true. Of course, the problem with the statement that only the things that science explains are true is that that statement itself can't be explained using science. You have at that point moved from science into philosophy and quite literally chainsawed off the branch that you were sitting on. And what I always want to say to people is, look, science is fantastic. Science is probably one of the best tools that human beings have ever invented. And it does a lot of things very well, but like all tools, it does some things well and some things badly. In the same way that a hammer is a marvelous tool for putting in nails. If you're putting a set of shelves up, if you want to do brain surgery, a hammer is probably not quite what you want, unless you're operating on certain politicians. And it's the same with science. I think science does certain things very, very well. And in particular, science tells us how stuff works. When you've got a world full of stuff, atoms and particles and molecules and so forth, science does a pretty spectacular job explaining how that works. But one of the things that science can't answer is how we have a world of stuff in the first place. And one of the things I find worrying is when people start trying to use science to explain why it is we have a universe in the first place. Science simply can't answer that question. It wasn't designed to do so. At that point, you've moved even beyond science. In fact, I think the very fact that we have a universe with atoms and particles, we have a universe with where the laws of physics, laws of science exist, where mathematics so beautifully describes our universe through the complex and intricate laws of physics. The fact we have that reality, to me, is one of the greatest pointers to God. And in fact, science, I don't think, is antithetical to God. Science is a great big signpost pointing in the God direction, saying, hey, there's something interesting here. Go take a look at it.
You know, you quote Mark Twain, which is, he had a great way of saying things, but he says, faith is believing what you know ain't so. And I'm just wondering, the new atheist suggests that, well, you know, if we're going to believe in God, it's equivalent to the Tooth Fairy or Santa Claus. Is it the issue of faith and reason that so many choose to be skeptical because they don't want to dive in the faith category?
Well, I think there is a degree of that. I think some atheists, have mistakenly assumed exactly faith means believing things which there is no evidence, or as Richard Dawkins put it, faith is believing things in the teeth of the evidence. And nobody really wants to believe things for which there is no evidence. We all want to be reasonable human beings, and so religion is written off. But what I say there is to go that the problem with that is that represents an utter misunderstanding of what the word faith means. That nowhere does the Bible say that faith means believing things for which there is no evidence. The Bible describes faith as a gift, but it's not the gift of stupidity. And in fact, the word faith is interesting. You see, the word faith, the English word faith, comes from a Latin word, fides, that means to trust. To have faith means to put your trust in something. It means to look at the facts, to look at the evidence, but there comes a point where you have to move beyond the evidence and actually put your trust in something. The analogy I sometimes use, if you're out walking in the wilderness in the backcountry somewhere, and suddenly an angry bear leaps out on you and chases you, and you, as you're running along, you're coming towards the edge of a cliff, and you realize you've got no choice but to jump or face the bear. And as you look over the cliff edge, you see three different trees growing out of the cliff edge. And very quickly, because you've got a background in botany, you assess that which types of plant those trees are. You did a bit of engineering at high school, so you're able to sort of assess the various forces those trees could hold. You could know every possible fact about those three trees, but ultimately you're going to have to put your faith in one of them if you're going to jump off the cliff and survive being eaten alive by the bear. Facts don't help you. Facts only get you so far. Or to use another more personal example, I've been married to my wife for 19 years. It was our 19th wedding anniversary yesterday. And, 19 years ago, 19 and a half years ago, when I asked her to marry me, I had all kind of facts I knew about my wife. I knew her, how she looked. I knew what she made her laugh. I knew her favorite food, all kinds of facts. But the moment I asked her to marry me, I was then putting my trust in her. I was moving from beliefs about to belief in. And that's what the Bible does. The Bible says, here's the evidence for who God is and all the things he's done in history. But the Bible says belief is not enough. In fact, the Bible doesn't want us to just believe in God. If you recall, the Bible says even the demons believe in God and shudder. What the Bible wants us to do is to look at who God is supremely, who he has revealed himself to be in and through Jesus. And then the question is not will you believe, the question is will you trust? And that's what faith means. It's not blind faith. It's looking at the evidence and saying, okay, now am I willing to make this personal and actually take an action based upon the facts that are in front of me?
Well, happy anniversary to you. Before our time is gone, let's talk about maybe some of the questions that we should be asking first before trying to give answers. And we were told First Peter, you know, always be ready to give an answer. But are there some questions we could be asking?
Yeah, I think there are three questions, actually, you can use. And questions are important because Jesus used questions all the time. Read the Gospels sometime and see how often in his dialogues with people he used questions. He was asked a question, he'd respond with a question. And I'd love to actually leave people with that. There are three questions that are really helpful to have in your back pocket as you engage with atheists and skeptics and folks who are not Christians. First question is, you can say to somebody, what do you mean by that? So when someone says something like, oh, I don't believe in God, you know, there's no evidence, rather than try and sort of leap in and provide evidence, start by saying, well, what do you mean by the word evidence? You know, what kind of evidence would be acceptable to you? What would you need to see for you to consider there was a God? So what do you mean by that? Look at what your friend has said and sort of deconstruct it a little bit. That's the first question. Second question is to say to somebody when they come out with a statement or an objection to the Christian faith, what's your evidence for that? So perhaps someone says to you, oh, I can't believe the Bible. It's a load of myths and legends and fairy tales. Why don't you just take that on the chin, look at them politely and smile and say, that's a really interesting perspective. Tell me, what's your evidence for that? How have you come to believe that? Because often our atheist friends just come out with a soundbite or a conclusion, but don't tell you their reasoning. And then lastly, the place I always want to try and take people in all of my conversations is to sort of push people into, what do you think about Jesus? Because ultimately, right, we're not going to argue someone into the kingdom of God. The Christian faith isn't about arguments primarily. It's about somebody seeing and grasping who Jesus is and then being forced to make that decision to answer that question that he asks every single one of us, who do you say that I am? And whether it's Muslim friends or Buddhist friends or atheist friends, I'm always keen to be thinking about how do I get them to actually take a fresh look at Jesus. And so a question like, who do you think that Jesus was? What do you think he meant when he said, you know, whatever? Anything I can do to get somebody actually looking at the person of Jesus, because he is the center of Christian faith. And that also reminds me that it's not about my clever arguments and my clever words. Our job as Christians is to introduce people to Jesus and then get the heck out of the way and let him take it from there.
Indeed. Well, we've had a good primer today to help us think through some of the issues and ask some of the questions. And I want to recommend the book, The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, or The Dreadful Consequences of Bad Arguments, written by Dr. Andy Bannister. Andy, if people want to find out maybe more about your work in ministry, can they connect through Ravi, or what do you recommend?
There are two places they can go. I mean, I wear two hats. I'm with Ravi a third of my time, so they can go to rzim.org, and they'll find Ravi's organization. And the organization I'm with in the UK is called SOLAS, and that's the Scottish word, the Gaelic word for sunshine, for sunrise. And they can go to SOLAS, SOLAS-CPC. That's the Center for Public Christianity .org, SOLAS-CPC.org. And then they can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all the kind of usual places. And in terms of the book, actually, we have a website, theatheistwhodidn'texist.com, theatheistwhodidn'exist.com, and you can download a free chapter and have a read and check out more about the book there.
Good to visit with you today, Andy. Thank you for your good work, and blesses you as you continue to minister and provide some good questions and some great answers.
Well, fantastic. It's been a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Dr. Andy Bannister joining us today. And you can find out more at solas-cpc.org, his organization in Scotland, joining us today via Skype. Coming up here in just a moment, Connecting Faith continues our every other Wednesday visit with Leith Anderson. We'll talk faith, church, and culture just ahead. Talking a little about belief and evidence today on Connecting Faith. We always appreciate the opportunity to talk about how we can put our faith into action. That's really what Connecting Faith is all about. And every other Wednesday, we have the opportunity to talk with Leith Anderson, who's president of the National Association of Evangelicals, and he also pastored for 35 years at Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, and has authored more than 20 books. And we talk faith, church, culture, and current events. And Leith, good to have you back on with us.
Good to be with you, Neil. You never seem to run out of topics.
There's plenty to talk about when we look around us. And you know, Ted and I have just been obviously watching the news, and we're going to talk about something that is called a Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA. The president decided that that program is going to end, and asking Congress to address the issue. Just, I know NAE put out a statement on that. Talk a little bit about your position on there.
Yeah, just a couple other words of explanation, probably. It's a program that was initiated by the Obama administration, and it's for those who were brought to the United States when they were children and gives them temporary legal status to work and be protected from being deported. So about 800,000 have signed up for this, and in order to qualify, they've needed to have a whole list of qualifications, school, work, keeping the law, and it's a whole list. And the NAE position is that our government should have permanent legal protection for these immigrants to stay in our country. Well, for a lot of reasons. In America, we don't punish children for the action of their parents. These children have grown up in the United States. They speak English. They have really no other place to go. And the potential damage to families is significant. Some of these who came under DACA are now in their 30s, could be in their mid-30s for the very oldest ones, and they have jobs and homes and mortgages and children and are in the military service. So to deport them, and when they have children, to leave their children in the United States, it just raises all kinds of moral challenges. So, Neil, the reality is that we've gotten ourselves into an immigration legal mess for a long time, and that Congress has punted, has postponed for years, and it's just time for our government to step up and fix our immigration system. But specifically on DACA, when following all the news this week, my thoughts turn to the Bible for some direction, and specifically to Numbers chapter 14. It tells the story of the Israelites when they were immigrating, when they were migrating to the Promised Land. And God responded to their lack of faith by barring them for 40 years until most of them died off. However, God gave an immigration exception to all of those who were under the age of 20 at the time. They weren't held responsible for the actions of their parents and leaders. So that's what the Bible says, and it makes sense. And I think we should follow that biblical example in our country.
Oh, well said. It's a great blueprint there. Leith, always good to talk to you. And another big story, of course, in the news is the weather in Texas, Hurricane Harvey, massive devastation there, and cleanup efforts underway in Houston and now Irma, of course, bearing down in the Caribbean and heading toward Florida. For many weeks to come, this week's going to be going on. So what are some ways that churches can be most effective to help when disaster comes?
Well, Ted, like you, I've watched this devastation and talked to people. Actually, I had another interview scheduled for this past hour, and it was with someone in Houston, and they still don't have continuous access to the internet or the telephone, so the interview was canceled. But let me tell you one of the things that just touched my heart through all of this, and that is that again and again there have been interviews that I've watched, and you've probably seen as well, where people who lost everything they owned, when they talk to a camera or to a microphone, they praise God. They thanked God. They declared their Christian faith. Answers to prayer was one of the most common phrases in the news, hour after hour. Even government officials talked about how the Lord was there when a police officer lost his life. And family members have talked about those they've lost going home to be with Jesus. And it wasn't just a few. This was a lot, and especially I saw and heard among African Americans and Hispanics and minority persons. Anyway, to answer your question, the church can do a lot, and it kind of depends on where they are. Churches and mosques in the flooded areas in Texas have opened their doors to refugees. They provided food and shelter and other assistance, and which is good for them. And then churches that are far away can't do that. So what they can do is pray and contribute, and contribute especially to Christian agencies like the Salvation Army and Convoy of Hope and World Vision. And then some churches can and have sent teams with boats and trucks and supplies. But one more note, and that is to remember that climate change and disasters are not limited to the United States. I think we lost a story that was going on at the same time as Harvey hitting Texas, and that was a typhoon that hit India with over 1,000 deaths. So there are other people around the world who are suffering, and we need to pray for them as well.
You know, see the government and churches and the aid groups working together. It's great to see that, but it seems like at the same time, you know, government increases pressure on religious liberties and public expressions of faith. Isn't there kind of a disconnect between those two?
Neil, government is a big word.
Yeah.
We're talking about hundreds, thousands of departments and millions of people. And we need to remember, they're not all on the same page. They don't even know each other many times. They don't even know each other's policies. So as churches and as Christians, we need to adapt in our responses to whatever the current issue and challenge is, and they're different. So in every situation, we're to be representatives of Jesus Christ on earth. And remember a verse that my wife Charlene often quotes, and that's 1 Peter 3:6. When dealing with the government or anything else, do what is right and do not give way to fear.
Yeah, I think that's wise advice any time we do that. So, hey, I want to ask you about the latest poll. NAE puts out a leadership poll regularly, and it was on where tithes and offerings should go. And talk about the findings and if you were maybe surprised by what the responses were.
Okay, well, define tithe. I assume you know what that means, right? Right.
The 10%. Yeah. A portion.
Okay, I won't ask you whether that's gross or net.
Okay, sure. All right, good. Thank you.
All right. So every month, National Association of Evangelicals conducts a survey of evangelical leaders. So the question we asked was, if you tithe, should all of it go to your church, or is it okay to split it up to other ministries, like Faith Radio? And of those that responded, 76% said it's okay to split it up. But, you know, I think the bigger issue here is probably not how we allocate 10%. Most Christians don't even give close to 10%. So, actually, I'm one of these people that read the New Testament to say that what we should do is give proportionally rather than legally at 10%. And the less we have, then we can give proportionally less. And the more we have, then we give proportionately more. So I know a couple that when they got married, they started at 10%, and they made a commitment together. Hold your breath on this. They made a commitment that they would increase their giving 1% per year until they retired. And they retired a couple of years ago, and they did it. And it worked just fine for them. Now, that's really proportionate giving. And I'm sure they distributed it to their church and beyond.
That's amazing. That's great.
It's quite incredible, yeah. Just a couple minutes left here with you, Leith Anderson. Thanks for your time again. It's after Labor Day now, and this is when churches are gearing back up for fall engagement and programs and hopefully getting attendees back into that habit. Do you have any recommendations for us today on how we can ratchet up our spiritual commitments?
Well, Neil, I want to ask you, not Neil, Ted, I want to ask you what ratchet up means, but I won't ask you. Well, let's just assume it means I'm going to pray more, or I'm going to read the Bible more, or I'm going to tithe, whatever it may be. When we hit holidays, especially the first of the year, January 1, but it's a good time to encourage people to make changes, to start new habits. You know, researchers tell us you got to do something for 3 months to turn it into a habit. So, sure, the start of school is a time for many families, especially families with children, that is maybe more important than the first of the year and the calendar year anyway. And so, yeah, let's encourage people to increase church involvement, community engagement, tithing, prayer, Bible reading, but encourage them to do it not just for a day or a week, but to turn it into a habit. And 3 months is the goal to make it into a habit.
I like it. As always, good insight and perspective from Leith Anderson, president of the National Association of Evangelicals. You can find out more about all their great programs and opportunities. NAE.net is the website. And we get together every other Wednesday to talk about culture and current events and faith in the church. Leith, always good to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us again today.
Thanks, Neil and Ted.
You're listening to Connecting Faith, and if you want to hear a portion of today's conversation, maybe with Leith or our earlier conversation with Andy Bannister. We post all those on the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com. It's myfaithradio.com, and you can click on Connecting Faith to find out more. Tomorrow, we're going to open up the phone lines and talk to Dr. Julie Stewart. Join us then. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.